For our panel, or rather for our forum this evening, we're presenting a panel discussing the social and ethical implications of technology. You might say a panel to talk about the uses and abuses of technology in today's world, or perhaps raising the question, is science outgrowing its usefulness? I'm myself not a technologist or a technician, I must admit, really not to be very good with machines at all. I'm usually at the losing end of any confrontation with a machine. I like to put pennies in vending machines and so on, but I don't know why, because the manipulation of them is beyond my ability. But I do have an interest in technology. One branch of philosophy that I'm interested in reflects on the impact of technology insofar as it affects man and man's position in the world. So I will try to participate from that perspective. Other participants of the panel include Larry Rasmussen, who is a social and political ethicist and theologian, Rudy Edmond, who is a geologist and has worked both in academics and in industry, and Leo Bustead, who is a biologist, an animal biologist, a veterinarian, animal physiologist, and many other things as well. Our format will be this evening that I will try to say something about the theme in general. Try to sketch out in some little way what technology is and suggest that there are four very broad general areas of concern when one considers the ethical and social implications of technology. Then each member on the panel will have an opportunity to make a brief statement in which they may choose to react to some of the things that I've said, or they may choose to go in a somewhat different direction. At any rate, in the course of about a total of 20 to 25 minutes at most, you will hear four brief statements dealing with this general issue. Then we'll open it for general discussion, questions, and conversation. At that point, I'll say something about the ground rules for the conversation so that as many of you as possible have an opportunity to participate. Technology, the idea of technology, comes from the Greek word techne. Techne really means art, or art in the sense of craft. The word techne approximates our notion of technique, or techniques of doing things. Ordinarily, then, technology has to do with ways of accomplishing things for the benefit of man. Technology tends to, or at least tended to, presuppose man's dominion over nature. Man, the technician, worked with nature, the raw material, in order to produce things or to change things for his own benefit. That is to say, technology tends to presuppose that nature is there for man to make use of. Nature is something for man to do something practical with for his own benefit, for his own well-being. This understanding of technology or techne is compatible with the notion, which is actually as old as Western civilization itself, that nature is inexhaustible, that you can just do things to nature for your benefit and you will always have more nature, more resources, whatever, to work with. As techniques improved through history, that is, as they were made more efficient, Techne became understood as the ways by which men were able to increase their power. And of course, the hardware by which men did increase their power also, to some extent, became identified with technology. Thus, the hammer is an extension of the arm, and in that sense, is an extension of our power in order to do something, manipulating nature, making something for our own benefit. Now, the power of technology increased manyfold when it was married to modern science. Modern science strives to understand nature in a comprehensive and systemic manner. And to the extent that science succeeds in this, the range of possible technological application is vastly increased. Thus, after technology has been married to science, most of the technology we think of today is this kind of modern scientific technology. Technology, after it has been married to science, no longer simply deals with nature as it is confronted in daily experience, but rather technology is capable of producing for us surprises from beyond the realm of ordinary, direct, everyday experience. Thus, in a very profound sense, technology, that is, modern scientific technology, creates and sets limits to the world in which we live. Central heating, automobiles, TV, and innumerable other technological inventions that we could think of form the content of our life world, the world that we live in. So whether we want it or not, much of our life is determined not by nature, of which we are a part, but rather by artifice, that is, by the actions of men. Thus, technology can regulate our lives in a way which is analogous to political regimes. Technology creates the conditions under which we live in a way which has as much or perhaps more impact than the political regimes under which we live. Now, thinking of technology in this way, I have thought of four general problems, ethical, social problems, that are generated by technology, and I'm suggesting that these four problems would be a fruitful topic for this evening's considerations. The first problem I'm calling the problem of responsibility, the problem of responsibility, and I suggest that technology raises a problem of responsibility in three distinct, although interrelated, senses. The first is that the technocrat, that is, the person who chooses, or the persons who choose, or the institution which chooses what technology will be developed, carried out, and so on, that is, the person or institution that, in a sense, creates the life world in which we live, this person or group of persons is not elected, is not chosen by the body politic, but is appointed by virtue of skills and inclinations and that sort of thing. The technocrat imposes his own will on the public without the normal sorts of political sanctions. Thus, the technocrat has a special kind of responsibility, or at least it would seem to me. Another sense in which technology raises a problem of responsibility is that at least some of the consequences of technology are not predictable. Technology sometimes operates on the model that we have a certain input. The input produces a certain output which we regard as desirable. But what there is between the input and the output, technology may not understand and may not be concerned with. Technology as such, at least, need not be concerned with what's in between the input and the output. And very often, people describing technology just call us a black box. There's something that happens in there, you know, we don't know what. Thus, there may be outputs which are not predicted, or which could not be predicted, and there may be side effects which are not predicted or could not be predicted. There also may be outputs which, in addition to not being predicted, we don't even recognize at the time. The consequences may only be evident sometime later. A couple of examples of this, if we consider the use of electroconvulsive therapy, that is shock therapy for the treatment of mental disorder. That's a technology where the input is applying electrical current to the brain. The output is a restored condition of sociability. But nobody, I think, yet knows why this works when it does work. Yet there have been consequences reported that were not predicted, not understood. A rather lengthy profile in the New Yorker magazine several years ago discussed the case of a mathematician working in advanced mathematics and industry who, in treatment for depression, was given electroconvulsive therapy, and upon returning to work, apparently happy and socialized again and so on, found that she was unable to perform the mathematical operations that she could perform before. So that would be a kind of output that was unpredicted because of this lack of understanding, at least in part, about what goes on in between the input and the output. At any rate, the important thing is that there are consequences which may not be predicted and may not even be recognized. Second order effects of the introduction of the automobile to our society would be another example. I think that nobody predicted or would have a way of predicting the consequences on society that the automobile had. Think of all of the things that are different because we have the automobile, the residential patterns, rise of shopping centers and drive-in movies and McDonald's and so on and so forth that really have altered our life. But that was not anticipated when the automobile was first put on the market. Another theme having to do with the question of responsibility then is the issue of irreversibility. Sometimes technological change produces a change which simply can't be reversed. The kind of thing that immediately comes to mind, of course, is the introduction of various sorts of toxic elements into the environment, and we don't know how to get rid of them. Perhaps we will discover a way to get rid of them. An answer sometimes given by technologists is we need a new technology to learn how to clean up the environment. But if it is the case that technology tends to have unpredicted consequences, then applying technology to solve technological problems may simply spiral into another kind of problem. Okay, so that's the first issue, the issue of responsibility. The second issue I'm calling the problem of excessive power. That is, modern technology is extraordinarily powerful, and this power itself seems to me to be to raise certain clear dangers. The misuse of power is always a danger, and since technology is capable now of generating so much power, the dangers are simply awe-inspiring. We think, for example, of the technology of nuclear warfare. Another sense of excessive power might be use of technology in the development of electronic means of surveillance and wiretapping and so on. Here you have a tremendous capability, but a capability which lends itself easily and obviously to misuse. Another sense in which the excessive power of technology affects our lives is the sense in which we become dependent on technology. If you live in a major city, if you live in New York, you know the consequences of a power failure. A power failure, sometimes due to a very small part failure or due to something like a coal strike leading to rat, but we're utterly dependent on this, and our whole quality of life is changed. We, in some sense, cannot defend ourselves against the technological failure. And this kind of power, it seems to me, that technology has raises certain problems. Now, themes one and two together suggests to me that man may become the victim of his own technology. It suggests to me that political systems such as totalitarianism may have an easier chance to be developed in a highly technological society. It seems to me that it's a danger that we need to consider that freedom of choice for future generations may become a mere fiction. Now, the third and the fourth issue, I think, are correlated with the first two. That is, correlated with the problem of responsibility and the problem of excessive power, but not as clearly correlated, but perhaps more specialized. The third power I'm calling the problem of the transfer of technology. On a small planet, the impact of modern technology and the lifestyle associated with modern technology may be disastrous for some cultures, partly because it's impossible now to repeat the evolution of technological process, so that if you apply the technology of 20th century Europe and America to a third world developing country, you're going to possibly destroy some indigenous cultural patterns or undermine some traditional value structures and reap many, many social problems. I observed something like this, I think, in a recent visit to Taiwan. Taiwan is modernizing like crazy and trying to take over as fast as they can for the sake of economic advancement, American style or American European style technologies. And the impact one sees everywhere you go on the peasant who has been displaced, relocated, thrust into the second half of the 20th century, very suddenly is moving and disturbing. The fourth area I'm calling the fourth problem is a different sort of problem that has not so much to do with technology and the use of technology, but rather has to do with attitudes toward technology. However, I think most of you will recognize these attitudes. I'm calling it the unwarranted faith in the efficacy of technology, that is to say, a kind of unwarranted belief that technology can do everything for us, that technology can solve all of our problems. I think that there is a strong tradition which believes that technology can solve most, if not all, human, social, political problems. There is a tradition that has dominated Western thought, or not dominated, but at least been very important in Western thought for some time, which has believed that if society can only be organized according to the principles of reason, then all social problems would vanish. One has seen this problem in the rise of social science and positivism. One has seen this approach taken by Marxism, and it's common. There's a technological version of this. The most frequently heard technological version of this approach is suggested by some Marxists who believe that if all of our mundane and divisive tasks could simply be taken over by machines, so that we would be free at last to do whatever we wanted, then life would be beautiful. I think that intuitively all of us would be skeptical about that. There's also a sense in which people believe that technology can solve all of our natural problems. In a discussion on the limitation of natural resources, a panel on public television recently, I heard Herman Kahn, the director of the RAND Institute, a think tank in New York, say that we don't really need to worry about limited resources, because always in the past, when we thought resources were limited, new technologies were developed which discovered new resources. we can count that on this in the future. He said, new technologies will discover new resources. Don't worry about the limited amount of petroleum. Some new technology will discover something else and things are going to work out all right. It seems intuitively obvious to me that there's something wrong with this approach. Another example of the belief that technology can solve all natural problems is seen in any modern hospital. If you talk to, as I have, terminally ill patients and their families, you'll find a large percentage of them who believe that their illness can be completely eliminated or that a cure is just around the corner. They're not going to die, and this cure is not going to be at the hands of the healing artist, the physician, but it's going to be a new technology. And to some extent, there are people who go so far as to believe, and this is at least the logical outcome of this point of view, that death is really an unacceptable option for man. What we need is a new technology, and eternal youth here on earth will be ours. So the four issues, then: the problem of responsibility, the problem of excessive power, the problems generated by the transfers of technology to third world nations, and finally, the unwarranted belief in the efficacy of technology to solve all of our problems. Okay. Should we just go down the line? No.
Hell has marched through several issues. I'm not going to address but a couple of them, and then do so in ways that I think supplement at this point some things he said. I'd like to say something to the question of responsibility and technology. And I want to ask whether not technology as such, but whether some kinds of technology have outstripped our capacity to make decisions concerning them, and have outgrown our normal capabilities for making decisions. Let me first just very briefly sketch what are normal decision-making categories. All of us think in terms of time and space. When we make decisions, we tend to make decisions on the basis of those persons who are closest to us, both in terms of time and space. When you make a decision about the future, you're not likely to make a decision to affect your behavior in the present on the basis of something 50 years down the road. You're likely to make your present decisions on the basis of something that you anticipate to be rather close at hand in time, 2 weeks, or something for your children. That may be a generation down the road. But and you'll make your decision on the basis of those who are closest to you: a family, your neighborhood, some important decisions in a larger circle, whether or not to go to war for your nation. Some of your decisions may include, as an influential factor, the condition of someone halfway around the world. Most of your decisions and my decisions are not going to be decisions in which we think of two generations hence, of a people whom we shall never know and whom we shall never see. Our time and space categories for our decisions are what we normally operate with, are close at hand. Furthermore, we generally assume that our morally significant persons are those who are our contemporaries. We do not, in our decision making, regard people who live 3 and 4 generations from now as morally significant as we make our day-to-day decisions. The question is whether some of our technologies do not have their most significant impact outside and beyond the range of our time and space categories. And I think we've developed a lot of technologies which will likely have their most significant impact not 2 weeks from now, not 3 years from now, but in a cumulative effect. Will be, in the biblical terms, visited upon the consequences will be visited upon the children under the third and fourth generation. So there's a real question in my mind of the response, scope of responsibility that accords with some recent technologies. Now, you can either go two ways in responding to this. You can either try and change the way in which you make decisions and try to have a sense of neighbor, if we want to use the way in which Jesus puts the focus of concern in the Christian ethic. If you want to change the notion of neighbor so that you really do make your day-to-day decisions on the basis of neighbors whom you will never see and who are not your contemporaries, or else you can try to change or have technologies that do not have consequences that far down the road or that distant from you. You can try and have technologies where the impact is rather close at hand, both in time and space, so you have some control. Otherwise, we get into this crazy position of making decisions about our technologies that are highly rational. We make as careful a calculation of the consequences as we can, but the second order consequences, the consequences after the immediate ones, happens outside of our sphere of decisions and outside of our sphere of control, which is not unrelated to what you talked about future generations then not having choices or their choices being limited. And our ethical consequences actually pushes technological consequences into the realm of circumstances or fortune or fate and rather than within the realm of human responsibility. So that's just an issue I want to raise, whether some kinds of technological developments haven't outstripped our normal human categories in decision-making, time and space and conceptions. Then another set of developments in technologies has led us to, I think, some new dimensions which we haven't had to face before. There's an article by Wolf Heffele, a nuclear physicist, in which he says, we've now come upon some developments which are unprecedented, and it, for the scientist, it poses a truly unique problem. And when, as we normally go about our scientific enterprise, we try to consider the consequences of proposed technological developments. We develop a laboratory demonstration so that we can see what the outcome of proposed changes might be. We know that you can't say what all of the consequences are going to be. You can only deal in probabilities. And in some degree or another, you have to deal with trial and error. Now, Heffele says, on a number of our developments and technological developments, we've reached the point where we can't carry out the experiment in a laboratory. The planet is the laboratory. And we don't know what the consequences will be. We can deal with in some probabilities, but we don't know what 300 nuclear power stations might mean. And we have no laboratory to test that out. The planet. We don't know. A lot of people love solar energy these days too. I do too. But if you think about huge fields of solar collectors, we don't know what the consequences of having huge fields of solar collectors, mirrors, would be for the climate in that region. There's only one way to find out. You can't experiment with that in the laboratory. You can only do it outdoors. What about the consequences if it changes the ecosystems in that region? Or DNA and some experiments with genes. There you can have some limited laboratory kind of experience, but you still have to do it in a way that it makes it for a different situation. So Heffel is one scientist who's concerned about the responsibility that attends to the magnitude of some consequences in some technologies. Okay, I'll shut up there on responsibility and only say one thing on this other issue that another issue you mentioned, Hal, and that was the transfer of technology. Since modern technology has developed in the West, we in the West have continued to underestimate the degree to which we have built in our assumptions and even our worldview into our technologies and the way in which they express that. We have assumed that technology is morally neutral, that it doesn't carry a way of seeing things and doing things. People from other cultures can tell us that technology is far from morally neutral. It rearranges patterns of human relationships. And that's what that's where morality rests, is in the kinds of patterns of human relationships that are structured. But we have just held to a proposed an assumed neutrality that simply is not the case whatsoever. And we often do not realize the degree to which we rearrange people's minds by introducing certain technologies into their society. Churchill's remark one time was, first we shape our buildings, then our buildings shape us. That's true. And what we have often done is shape our buildings and then ship our buildings. And then that has shaped someone else. And we have done that holding to an assumed neutrality, which just does not exist.
Okay, good.
Well, I think the two remaining scientists are faced with some real challenges here that we recognize. I'd like to just point out, I think that science and technology are really two different things, very different. Science being really the discovery of truth and knowledge, and in a very broad way and in a very deep way. Then going beyond that, then the practical things that come out of the discoveries of science are the things that are made into technology. And technology really grows out of knowledge, which really is scientifically something that we have learned, and principles and relationships and so on. All of which really is not anything separate from God's total creation. As you look at God's creation and from a scientific point of view, this is really our attempt to understand what has been created. And that's where science really comes in. It's human activity in an attempt to understand the creation in all of its complexity. And in doing so, we have discovered many, many things. And then beyond that, the scientist, you see, becomes separated from the activity when it's picked up as a technological development. And speaking of the technocrat who really takes this knowledge and then applies it to society, to people, to his or her own life, and so on, then this becomes really a very different kind of thing. Now, I think there is no question that we cannot reverse knowledge and reverse the understanding of truth in terms of the natural laws and in terms of God's creation. What we have learned, we have learned. What we do with what we have learned is an entirely a different problem. And what we decide to do then with the knowledge we've gained then becomes, that's the point where the responsibility lies. Now, it certainly is the responsibility, as I see it, of Christian people to know all there is to know about knowledge, about the earth, about the universe, the solar system, and all of these things that really are a way of understanding the great gifts we've been given in creation and the ongoing creation. So if we then take the knowledge that we have and turn it to a use which does not benefit mankind or does not bring glory to the creation, then something is basically wrong. And to excuse this in terms of saying it's the technologists who have loused things up, or the technocrats, it's really, there's no technology that is being practiced that the people do not want. Somebody wants it, or it wouldn't be a thing that is applied. If we think about travel, and you travel in a jet airplane, if you consider this technology, if this is something you want, and you do it, but how do you do and control the things then that relate to transportation, to our greater and greater communication, so that we know a great deal more about all kinds of things, disease, everything else. And this is simply an expansion again of the scientific knowledge in a technical sort of way. And the responsibility comes right home to the people who buy the technology. And you can't just excuse it on the technologists selling it to you. You have bought it. Now they really force it on society. No, society has asked for it and bought it. And that's where I think the real responsibility lies. And I think I would like to put it in the framework of true stewardship. As this is stewardship of our resources, of the knowledge we have gained in terms of what we know about God's creation, and all of the things that we have discovered as truth. And then it's a question of how we treat God's creation in terms of applying what we know. And if we choose to apply the kinds of things that we all know are part of the technology, then I think it really rests with us to manage the future. And we have to manage the technology. Technology and science is too important a human activity to be left to strictly the elite of the scientific world or the technological world. It's a problem for all of society, and all of society must be involved in it and must accept the responsibility for what you bring on in terms of technological development and in terms of values and that kind of thing. And so I would just like to put it on that framework, and then Leo, let you comment on what you think it might be. It's a good anchor, man.
I wish you wouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
It's better to be first than last. When in doubt, you tell a story. One day, an audience was gathered to hear a concert, and they noticed that the smoke was coming out from under the curtain, and people became very disturbed, and some of them began to leave. And one of the musicians, not wanting the audience to leave, walked very confidently up to the piano and sat down and very deliberately began to play very beautifully. And the audience came back to their seats and burned to death. The piano player is pictured as science and technology. When I was growing up, science and technology was everything, and I became a scientist, or some of my people maybe thought I was a pseudoscientist, but we made some efforts. And but in recent times we've heard these kind of stories, and some of them are true and some are false, relative to the knowledge base. I am disturbed on a couple of items, and to express my concern, and I'll try to get back to addressing these very briefly, because some of you should make some comments. I did work in, spent much of my time in looking at the environmental impact of energy utilization, part of it in the nuclear field. J. Robert Oppenheimer, who was a genius, made the remark that when you see something that is technically sweet, you go ahead and do it, and then argue about what to do it only after you have had this technical success. And and related to this, and then you'll see where I'm coming from, it was Mendelssohn at Harvard who said five, 6 years ago, he mentioned that, you know, science has outlived its usefulness. And he told a story about one day that he's talking to a behavioral psychologist, and it was at the time that the relationship of behavior and intelligence was much in the news, and a proponent of this and a defender of it made quite a case for it, and this friend of Mendelssohn's didn't like this fellow, and so Mendelssohn sort of baited him. He says, well, you're a psychologist, and this fellow was just reporting the truth. Don't you, as a behavioral psychologist, respect the truth? And he said that he did. He respected the truth only slightly less than compassion. I am concerned about the person. And my big hang-up on this whole thing, and I think Rudy has stated the case for science well, and technology, I think my concern is the knowledge gap. The application of science and many of the scientific principles, the application before we're really ready for it. Mm-hmm. Now I say that, however, with some misgiving, relating back to what Harold said. We used penicillin very effectively, and it saved millions of lives. Still saves them today, although it kills also some people. But it saved millions of lives without knowing how it works. By the same token, we vaccinated a lot of people without knowing, you know, how generous friends will work. We realize that, but we have knowledge gaps. Now, I'll give you a couple of examples. First of all, I respect much of technology. I have some very dear friends who have heart pacers, wouldn't be alive today, and I could not enjoy them had not the technology of pacers been in. My wife will walk without pain soon because somebody developed technology for complicated hip surgery. And we can name many of these, can't we? It's a bane and a boon. But we extend them too far, and we make political decisions, some of which I've been involved in. I had a very interesting afternoon and evening with a fellow named Jim Irvin, who's a remarkable fellow, who probably won't live out his normal lifespan, although he was a real physical specimen par excellence, probably better shaped than most individuals were. He spent 3 days on the moon, and when he came back off the moon, of course, he had arrhythmia. So did his partner, but his partner got over it. Now his training for this was above and beyond really the call of duty, and he gave 200 or 300%. Well, as a result of this expedition, I'm going to lose a good friend early. I don't like to do that. And you know, was the trip necessary? And if you had asked me even before, I would have said the trip wasn't necessary and it was very costly. And I consulted in some aspects of it. Some of these decisions are it's a very complicated thing. It's my tenth law. There's no complex problem which, if looked at in the proper way, doesn't become more complex. And it really is, you know. You know, I was involved, for example, in the evaluation of the Kanikin shot. Now, some of you don't know what that is, but we made a decision to detonate a nuclear device, very deep in Amchitka Island. We'd made two other tests before, didn't we? Now it wasn't my decision to say, you know, you shouldn't do that. Well, I can say you shouldn't do that. That's somebody else's decision, I guess. But it's very involved, and it's a global decision. Because there is evil in the world, and somebody who is considered our enemy says they already know we haven't. They have a system that works, and they've tested it, and they know we haven't tested ours, and this was the test, I suppose. And now we made a decision. Somebody made a decision to go. And the decision they were going to go. What is the consequence? Now, there were many people who said it will cause a tsunami, a tidal wave that will do some terrible things. It will contaminate the fisheries and wipe them out for Alaska forever, or that region. It will trigger earthquakes that will be very destructive. And it will compromise the biota of Amchitka Island. Now, a panel of us sat and said, it will not cause these various things, and it didn't, and it hasn't. But you know, if you would have asked me, should you do this? You know, I'd have voted no. Huh? But there many of these are out of our hands and very difficult, and that's what makes it so terrible. But my question is always, what is the impact of people? And we're talking about the third world. And there's another area of this that's very disturbing to me. We have a condition, I'll just name one, asbestosis. It isn't a good thing to breathe. And we're paying for this. And so we put on very strict limitations, don't we? And what happens? We go to Mexico and make it there, or some other country and make it there. Not always respecting the standards that we have, and the stuff gets in with the children, and we also do this with other agents, and there's something that's very disturbing about that. It ain't right. And it's technically sweet a lot of times, or there's some motivations here that we better address, and as Rudy says, and as he has put into a book that will soon be published, and it's as well that we read it. But these are the very disturbing things to me, but we have very fine, I think, test systems for this. We say, you say, well, we don't know what 300 reactors will do. Well, I think we do know a good deal about what 300 reactors will do. We have done fantastic amounts of research over many generations of many animals. And I've been involved in some of this work, where many generation after generation has been tested at the expense of taxpayers' money. Very carefully done. So we know what what these consequences are. I'll admit we don't know what solar is, and that is a great concern. We have many knowledge gaps. I guess my plea is that we should all work for more knowledge in many areas before we make the jump to the technology, with the bottom line always being, what will this do to a people?
Okay, thank you. Now, 25 minutes, there's another principle of technology that sometimes these things get out of hand, I'm not sure. At any rate, I'd like to invite any and all of you that want to ask questions or make comments to do so. You can address questions to any member of the panel individually or to the panel generally, or just make a comment which is on the floor for anyone to pick up. But let's simply try as well as we can to give everyone that wants to make a point the opportunity. So it's open. Reactions, questions?
Yeah. What are you defining as a technocrat? Can you give me an example of people that are technocrats?
Yeah, I don't know that I have a really precise definition. It seems to me that who a technocrat is varies given the political and social circumstances. But at any rate, a technocrat would be one who does technology at a high enough level to have some social impact, a manager, managerial level, something like that.
Henry Ford.
Yeah, I would suppose Henry Ford would be. The kinds of decisions that he made have had the sort of impacts that I was talking about. Yeah.
Hand over here.
Yeah.
I have a bit of a concern on the employment of technology, as the first two gentlemen have used it. Essentially, that technology is bad. And I'm concerned because it's not technology per se that's bad. It's a rather inert substance, it seems to me. It's the employer of the technology. And whether the technology is employed, it seems to me there's a continuum that not all of it is bad, not all of it is good. It's a mixture. Henry Ford's automobile, it's been responsible for covering up a fair portion of our country with concrete and asphalt. It's made some jobs. It's altered the courtship habits of American youth. But there have been other positive things. And I'm seeing two alternatives. One is sort of a sense of future cower. The technology is bad, and somehow we've got to avoid it. We've got to do without it. I think you cited something like wiretapping and atomic power generation, and so on. That we must, with some sort of a neurotic outlook, go into the future. And the alternative to that is some sort of a 19th century primitivism. So we're going to do without it. There's a resultant glorification of maybe a peasant culture, peasant virtues, back to the land. I don't want to go back there. 15 hours a day, I've seen the 5-acre rice plots in Japan where they literally grub out the minimal amount of calories barely to sustain livelihood. People were old very, very soon. I wish we could address the fact that the morality of the employer of the technology is the issue. The fact that there should be a conscience that whoever employs the technology that could be pricked, that could be dealt with so that the abuses do not occur.
Do you want to respond to that?
Well, Wayne had, is it on this point? I would like to say something, but if you do, go ahead and say, address
it
first.
Well, yes, it is related to the point, because I see four people up here, two scientists, one ethicist, and one philosopher, and what we're clearly missing, and not in terms of any reflection on the group, I think it's an excellent panel, but we're clearly missing political science. We are inadequate in terms of our political mechanisms that can stand as some kind of a buffer zone between a science that can become arrogant and a technology that can certainly become arrogant, in terms of at least stating to the potential consumers, here are the risks involved. There are probabilities that this may do some damage, and we want to know the extent of the damage, much like what Leo was dealing with on this underground explosion. But just think of the pesticide that we've incorporated with nothing to forewarn us in any way that this could turn back on us. A number of instances were mentioned here about the creation of of technologies, which kind of made us feel good because we knew we could do them, but we didn't know what the penalties were. We don't have any political mechanisms, and it seems to me we can talk very well from science and technology and from an ethical point of view, but we've got to get the political mechanisms in, else we're talking in the air.
Mm-hmm.
I think Rudy was bringing up that point. It seems to me that the science of regulating technology, I mean the appropriate political science to manage in a technological world is one that perhaps we don't have the capability for right now. I think that may be a more complex art than I'd be curious to.
Yeah, and my point relates to yours is to make appropriate decisions, such as the Kinnikin Shun. You have to have a knowledge base, and I make a plea for a knowledge base, so that you can make appropriate cost-benefit risk analysis.
But who would you inform?
Pardon?
Whom would you inform?
Well,
once you make the evaluation. Right now you work with the bureaucratic element, which is fine, but can't we do better than that?
Yeah, many of our decisions, I don't know if you're familiar with the process, and one of it relates to all of us here, and that's in the food protection area. Do you take saccharin off or don't you take saccharin off? Mm-hmm. Or on cyclamate, for example. And I sat on a group, there is a National Academy of Sciences, National Research Council, part of the Assembly of Life Sciences of the National Research Council. And they have a number of committees, so-called people who are supposed to be best informed in the various fields covering this. And they have usually a 3-year period in which they serve, and then they go to someone else. And you get all the information available on this subject. And then you make these recommendations, that material is made available to the bureaucrats, to the legislators, in many cases. They ask for the studies, and the decision was made. The decision on cyclamate was political and probably didn't fully respect the information extended. I would say the consensus on the committee was that it's true, if you would have drank 600 bottles of Coca-Cola with cyclamate in it every day, for the next 60 years, you might have had some slight chance of increasing the bladder cancers, very slight probably, but it would be, you would have trouble getting by the first day. and you see, and now I guess if they, in the cool of the evening, if they had to make the decision again, they'd probably put cyclamates back. But that's much of the process on this, and they get the best information they can get. You know, there's few people without prejudice. But you try to get the data, but there again, I make an appeal for a knowledge base. And it is the rat, it is putting the material in beeswax and putting it in the rat bladder, the best test system, you see? Well, I have some problem with that. I'm a pig and sheep man myself. but that's for another day. Yeah. But no, you had to, it's the process, and we our system is probably better than any others, but we do make some mistakes, and a lot of it is a response to political pressure, independent of science. Is story I often tell here. It's about maybe I've told some of you. It reminds me of the fellow, the desert nomad, who would each night go into his tent, and he'd light a candle. And he'd get a bowl of dates, and he'd eat these. And this one day he picked up this date, and it had a wormhole in it, so he put it down. Picked up another one, had a worm in it, so he put it down. And he went and blew out the light, and went back and ate the date.
Categorically pro-technology or anti-technology, I don't think that helps anybody. One has to assess different kinds of technologies. However, I would disagree that I think it's a disagreement, I have to check that out. The focus to ask the question of moral assessment isn't only on the employer, but it is also on the impact of that particular kind of technology. Technology isn't simply an inert substance. I mean, if it patterns human work relationships in a certain way because the technology is asked for an assembly line, you have a certain way of patterning human relationships. A different kind of technology may do it differently. I'm only saying that matters in a moral assessment, and not only to check the motivations and the character and the intentions of the employer.
Well, I must confess, while you were talking, it left to my mind the instance of a Swede who set out to invent the bottle and invented dynamite instead. Nobel.
Yes.
The fact that
for peace purposes, incidentally, yeah. Only for peace. I mean,
yes. That's exactly what I was thinking of. Because try not to tell you, it would be a marvelous thing to break up a log jam or certainly to flood the village.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's a marvelous device to frag somebody with for a terrorist.
Yeah.
You see, and so it does us a little good to condemn dynamite per se, because it's how it's employed. Now maybe give me another example in your mind where
one that was from this morning. One that was from this morning, and I tried to say it earlier and didn't do very well. Some kinds of technologies express a view of the world that puts humanity over against nature, and that has built into it an understanding that we can do with material. That's there just as we damn well please, and it's a dominion over, in the worst sense, kind of view, or a view of history that sees it on a line rather than some other way. And there have been lots of instances of introductions of technologies into cultures that. By asking people to do things in a certain way, you've asked them to change their way of life and their values in order to do it that way. And so it isn't simply a neutral a thing, and you don't make the assessment of it in terms of those who are exporting the technologies, or even what the technologies may do something very, very well. You may need to increase food production, and you may have starving people. Well, one ought to increase food production with starving people. But one ought not to leave out of the assessment what else does it do, that particular way of increasing food production to the life in that society. Now we're getting much more sensitive about that than we used to be, but that's an example of where you don't have a technology that simply is morally neutral.
I should point out, I'm very interested in cost-benefit risk analysis and factoring into it, into the equation what we know in science. But the unknowns here are very difficult as far as the effect on a people.
Sure.
And which is very hard to predict. And one, for example, the oil at the North Slope. Now, I guess in the final equation, this will probably help us for a few years. And the cost of it is, I suppose you can say, it compromised the culture of a people.
Yeah, it's a good example, I think, or at least potentially a good example of what's Eskimo culture.
Yeah,
I think along with the oil on the North Slope, I'm sitting out in western North Dakota on the coal field, in where I think, if I recall right, what are we, about 10% efficiency burning this coal, converting it to energy. Well, and like Don says, you don't want to go back, But I think we're going to have to go back a little. I think, for me, sitting out there farming, I'm seeing we're going bigger and bigger and bigger, machinery, equipment, that we're... And in order to stay in the farming business today, it looks to me like, you have to go along with the ballgame, just like everything else, big, big, big. And, but I sure hate to give up my farmland for 10% efficiency of the conversion of the coal, that we're not using technology to its fullest in that way. I think if we're going to use the coal, let's look at some reclamation first and then have a little more efficient way of using it.
Yeah. Now, part of it has been covered, but there's a moral question. Maybe this is what Leo was getting at, the cost-benefit analysis. There are times when maybe a culture, the choice might have to be between destroying a particular culture or that culture making a decision itself to either adopt technology and maybe result in a change of that culture or death. Now that's a moral question. Now that's something that they have to make themselves. Sometimes we have to make it when we go into Alaska. That was a decision that we made. Maybe that was an error to do that. But what about the decision that was made in this country, flu vaccination here a couple of years ago, turned out to be kind of a flop, I guess, I don't know. But the only thing that we really heard about it was the few deaths that resulted from its use. Maybe it prevented a greater death, the greater number of deaths by using it. This type of thing, it isn't a matter of deciding that technology is bad, and because it might be bad, and not even knowing how bad it might be, that we should not use it. If we know that there is some benefit to be gained, you've got to serve the... Well, it's a question of serving the people today or maybe 50 years from now. This is part of the moral question, too. Who do you decide to serve? The people that are living today or those generations coming?
Yeah, in mentioning four problems with technology, I didn't mean to suggest that these were four indictments of technology or that technology was bad, but rather that it seems to me that technology, or at least modern scientific technology, does indeed change our lives in ways that we ought to be very attentive to. And for example, talking about the transfer of technology from one culture to another, the point there was not that technology ought not perhaps to be applied in a certain culture, but whether or not the technology as developed, say, in the United States, was in that form simply portable to a place like Taiwan, or whether or not we needed to think a lot more carefully about the sense in which human relationships would be altered by this technology in this form, and perhaps develop a technology that would be more sensitive to cultural needs.
Yeah, are you asking the question, when you say when we export the technology, are you saying that we should determine the technology that's used, or shouldn't they determine which they want to use, or should we influence their decision as to what technology they employ?
Now, I think that Standard Oil of Indiana or RCA or some company that moves into Asia to have a plant of cheap labor does have a moral responsibility to consider whether or not the form of operation is going to have an adverse effect on the culture. So I think that the agent of the application of the technology has some responsibility. I think probably responsibility is shared by the government leaders who accept this sort of thing, about the people that seem to ask for it, and so on and so forth. But at least I think that some responsibility in this, say, this Taiwan example, would have to be borne by, say, Standard Oil of Indiana. But not all of it.
But is this really a politically feasible approach for us to make some decision as to how much technology they should use or how they should use it?
Well, I think that there are lots of political problems. I agree with the comment before that we really need a political scientist to help us sort these things out. Yeah.
I'd like to comment, coming back to Rudy's remark.
Yeah, and I think Rudy has
science, if you think of science as pure science, and the technology as applied science, which is substantially the difference. Science is a search for knowledge, and there's no way in which that is either arrogant or can be controlled. People who want to find the truth, any nation, scientists appear all over the world. But now once you start to apply it, then I think we get problems that we're beginning to see today globally. Now, what are the factors that influence the development of technology? And I mean development as well as exploitation. And I think we'll find they're both political and economic. And if you look at the laboratories around the world, and in the United States today, unlike pure science, by and large, the scientists choose the development of the things they're doing for economic or for political reasons. When I say political, I mean that substantially our technological development pointed towards defense I classify those as political. And the rest are economic. If you work for an Exxon, you work on those kinds of things that relate to Exxon's products. If you work for an aerospace company, you by and large work on independent research and development that relates to those things. And so I think the scientists there are not exercising free choice in the development of technology. They're working on those things. They can change their company if they wish and work on other things. And so Joe Califano said the other day, being somewhat alarmed at the developments in biology and the possibilities of cloning and so on, said that science is too important to be trusted to the scientists, and one could equally say that it's too important to be trusted to the politicians or the economics. Well, I think it's a problem of people. I don't think we want to personalize technology, but I think all of us have to share that problem. I don't think it's the responsibility of the scientists to determine what the ultimate results will be. They have to share part of the, use their talents to do that. And Harold, I think it's totally impossible. You presented two options, I recall, or was it you, Harold? That maybe we should either develop our decision-making process to be further up, or only develop those technologies that we have immediate consequences. I think that second option is totally impossible. You cannot develop things where you're learning about them and yet and know that they only have a positive impact. So I think
that was my comment, and it was a way of saying that one can develop technologies where you have a better understanding of the chain of cause and effect down the line, and some other kinds of technologies you find it harder to trace those consequences.
As a scientist, I feel that's impossible. By definition, if you're developing something new, you cannot know the impact of it, so that you must take your first option.
But that, it comes down to an ethic of prudence. Do you then go ahead and develop that if you can't know that? Or what I'm trying to say is that a lot of our technologies have not yet been matched with a sophisticated ethic of risk. We haven't developed the terms for that.
And you see that there's a real danger of control. Then you might decide not to develop along those lines. But I think at the beginning, if you think of the technology is just a first application of your science, I think you won't at that point know.
I'd like to add
another point to this. You know, I think there's a very direct correlation between the expanding population of the world and the development of technology, in the sense that we have exported from the developing countries to the developing countries, from the developed countries, really exported death control.
Sure.
But we have not exported birth control. Well, in that sense, in terms of living with the potentialities that we have on the earth. And so we're just moving ahead trend-wise on a very dangerous course from a point of view of food as well as other things. And we're kind of at the point where an airplane is when it gets so far down the runway, the pilot knows when he has to fly rather than stop at the end of the runway. And I think we're beyond that point in terms of the number of people on the earth and the abandoning of technology. You can't think that that's a possibility. If you're going to keep alive and provide life in its meaningful sense for the people that exist on the earth, we have a responsibility. Now, how do you discharge that responsibility? Is it in a better way of dealing technologically with that population? Or what are the alternatives? I think these are the hard questions. I don't have any answers.
Give them Swiss sleep. There's a great drug out. It's great if you have to travel through many time zones. It's called Rohypnol. It isn't cleared in this country yet, but you take it and you go to sleep, and it's a great sleep. That's you're asked for an answer.
One answer. Let the plane fly.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to make a comment about the separation of science and technology. There was a lot of talk last year when they were doing the recombinant DNA research in Cambridge about whether or not they should go ahead with that. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of thing would set a little dangerous precedent against for being afraid of looking for new things and new scientific truths and knowledge. And it seems to me that the whole question gets down to the matter of making ethical questions about not doing something that you have the capability to do. But I think it's important to separate the functions and to go ahead and look down any avenues you want to, as long as you retain the control to decide that, well, we can do this, but maybe we shouldn't.
Yeah, who retains?
We can be afraid of looking at new things.
Yeah, who retains that control, and how do you retain it? I at least want to play devil's advocate with that position expressed by yourself,
okay.
Rudy. It comes down to some judgments about human nature in the end. If with some people you make a judgment that, say, evil and good grow apace, and that anything which is discovered can be used to good purposes as well as evil purposes, and that history is a complicated enough affair that you can't be sure that you can control the uses of that knowledge. If you go that direction, then at some point you may face a situation where you say, gosh, our knowing about all we can about our genes, you know, is holds its enormous potential benefit, that we must go ahead and we'll control the use of that. The person who, and like I'm trying to do now, playing devil's advocate on that, says, look at the record of history. Someone, somewhere, will see it to be in his or her advantage or nation's advantage to use that knowledge to some far more malicious end. And then the whole question of who's, you know, who's control, who's in control.
Well, I can see that point. I can play devil's advocate in return. That who makes the decision about what you decide to go into and or not go into? You do it by marches, as they did in Cambridge, or
well, the issue at Cambridge, though, wasn't it more emphasis on the sufficiency of containment?
Yeah, I think that was more a regulation of the research.
Yeah. Well, I guess what bothered me about that was the fear aspect.
Yeah.
You don't have an Andromeda strain.
Yeah.
Well, we describe some of these situations as problems or potential problems, as you did the outline of the four areas, one of them being the problem of transfer technology. We do set up certain standards of what we consider proper and improper. We'll use the example in Alaska that perhaps we destroyed the culture by owning technology. Have to keep in mind that we're doing something similar with the Eskimos and trying to save the whale.
Wally.
The one species that they severely, drastically limited the hunting by the Eskimos will probably also destroy their culture equally well. And so we're setting up, on the one hand, okay, it's all right to save certain environmental objects. But on the other hand, we should preclude certain technological
development. Yeah, I think that's a good point to bring up. In a way, you have to understand that cultures are always going to be changing, and if they are changing and developing, that of course means that some aspects of the cultures are destroyed along the way. And it would be somehow foolishness to assume that it could be otherwise. What I meant to raise as an issue here was simply that understanding technology is something which has an impact which is extraordinary. I'm basing this particular problem on the notion that modern technology, at least in some areas, has an extraordinary impact, and that this may, tip the balance more radically and suddenly, then we know what to do with.
Well, isn't there a hopeful note that man has been given a wonderful brain by God, he's gotten himself into a pickle here, and if he recognizes that there is a problem, shouldn't man, with the help of God, be able to reverse the situation and get back onto a right kind of track? Seems to me we have to live in a hope that these trends, if they need to be reversed, can be reversed by the same species that created them. Is that possible?
No.
Okay. Not possible.
It seems to me that at least our theology, at least as I understand it, says that God has given us our brain, and our brain may get it into that pickle. But the brain is not going to take us out of the pickle. It may make the pickle into relish. So we can squirm out. It seems to me that with that, and with our trust in God, and that bad situation, someplace along the line can be recreated into something good. But the situation can't reverse itself. I don't see history as repeating itself, or would suggest a reversal, or going back again. That's my perspective on it. Now, what does that mean? You know, we're stuck with a problem, and we have to recreate and to renew from that. I'm not too sure. You know, lately there's been some C&D, you know, great movies on what happens after the next nuclear holocaust. You know, and it's really raunchy science fiction, but it's sort of fun to play with some of those ideas of what are they saying about having to start all over again. And let's make the best of our situation. They're not too theological, but it strikes some ideas in my head in terms of, you know, the necessity of recreation of the gospel thing, which is not saying we go back to base one.
Well, I don't know if you meant base one. I mean, it's an amelioration is what you're...
Well, our time is actually up. Are there some final comments that anyone wants to make before we call the forum officially over, and then anyone who wants to stay and continue, you're free to, but I want to release the panel from their obligations. Any final comments?
Good night.
Good night. Have a good sleep.
Thank you, everyone.